There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
Hello, everyone. From time to time here on Wild, I like to share a fun episode where I've been interviewed over at another podcast platform. So recently, the podcast Intelligence Squared asked me to lead a discussion with English author and journalist Oliver Berkman. Intelligence Squared happens to be one of my favourite podcast channels. It's a British podcast that sees public intellectuals, politicians, authors, and philosophers discuss the big issues of the day, sometimes as an in conversation and at other times as a debate around a contentious idea. And Oliver happens to be one of my favourite writers. We were invited on to discuss our scepticism around the self-help industry, but our chat meanders out from there. It was a fun experience, and I hope you enjoy it. We will return to the Ask Me Anything format again next week, so keep posting your questions over at Substack. That's sarahwilson.substack.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Intelligence Squared event, The Skeptic's Guide to Self-Help. And my conversational sparring partner this evening is Oliver Berkman. Oliver wrote the anti-self-help self-help column. This column will change your life, some of you may recall it, for The Guardian for 10 years. During this time, he investigated pretty much every productivity hack, mindfulness trick, happiness boost we've ever been fed, and wonderfully, to my relief at least, he concluded almost none of them work. He has published three books: The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking, Help, How to Become Slightly Happier and Get a Bit More Done, and most recently he published the hugely popular 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And this book has actually been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 10 weeks, and I think the international rights are with 20 different territories. So I'm sure many of you have read the book by now, and he'll be feeding some of the content from that into this conversation this evening. Now, tonight's event is going to run for about an hour. For the first 45 minutes or so, Oliver and I will be in conversation, and then I'm going to be taking your questions. If you have a question, post it as we go. You can start posting them now. Clicking on the Ask Question button under the video screen and type in your question there. If you want your name to be mentioned, type it into the box. You don't have to. Then press Send. The other thing I'll just add to all of this is that you are welcome to tweet to us using the hashtag IQ2. Okay, so Oliver, welcome. It's great to join you here once again. We've interacted a couple of times over the years. Yeah, in this space, in this wellness, self-help kind of space. And I might kick off by getting you to explain how you wound up in the self-help realm. I think it was around about the same time that I did. We were living parallel lives on the opposite side of the world. Let's get to your story first, how you wound up writing your column and what was the interest in this topic at the time?
Yeah, well, I'm really happy to be here having this conversation, and thanks everyone who's joining us. I mean, the sort of surface level story, the professional job level story of how I came to be sort of writing that column, which I did for quite a lot more than 10 years, I think. I actually realize now it's terrifying. Anyway, was just that I was reading all these books myself, and my then editor at The Guardian Weekend magazine cannily realized that she could get some copy out of me about it, given that I was already clearly to be seen round the office reading books on time management and productivity. Not so much at that point, maybe spirituality and what gets called wellness today, but that came later. So already there's this kind of slight problem in my interest, which is that I sort of began that column being relatively sarcastic and maybe more than skeptical, maybe almost cynical about a lot of what I was writing about. And yet, clearly, I'd been very interested in it, like interested enough to read it. And I think that goes to the heart of my sort of engagement with it, which has always had that sort of double edge to it. And in many ways, the journey of writing that column, in many ways, was just a kind of process of getting slightly less cynical, maybe even less skeptical. I thought at first the fun thing would be sort of poking fun at all the terrible self-help, and there's plenty of it. But actually, the really fun thing is suggesting to a typical Guardian reader that there might be something useful and practical or mind-expanding or peace of mind-inducing about what you might find shelved under self-help in a bookstore. So in many ways, that was what I did. At the same time, of course, you know, you get to test out 100 different productivity systems and systems of, you know, designed to make you have happier and more pleasant days. And there's something very beneficial about testing out so many, because you get to the bottom of the barrel, right? I mean, you get to the point where, oh, well, if I've done this, if I've tried 100 of these and none of them have worked, maybe that tells me something interesting about the nature of the journey that I'm on, rather than just that, you know, I haven't found the right one yet. Somebody with a more, you know, a more useful job to society than me might have only have time to try out 3 or 4. And therefore you might think that the real one was just around the corner, but I can tell you that it isn't. And so that was sort of an interesting place to get to. And then I think 4,000 Weeks really is the book I wanted to write sort of after that journey, and trying to say something concrete about kind of building a meaningful life in the absence of these kind of easy solutions. I don't know. Yeah. That's my thought. How about you?
Mm. Yeah, well, I think you've mentioned that you started out in about 2006. At that time, I was the editor of Cosmo. So I was editing a Bible of self-help stuff and selling a whole heap of stuff to young women that they really didn't need. That was my introduction, but I got very unwell, and I did what I'm sure many of the listeners would have done, is take off into the forest and live in an army shed on my own in an effort to get better. And the wellness sphere was starting to emerge. So I had this wonderful idea as a journalist like yourself of pitching a column where I wrote about different ways to get well in order to heal myself. It was sort of it was the smartest career move I've ever made, to be honest. Now, this was in about 2009, 2010 at this stage, and I went on a similar journey. I remember reading some of your columns. We were writing about some of the similar trends and themes and hacks and advice and, you know, interviewing similar people. But eventually I stumbled across, well, I was out of a topic for one particular week, and I figured I'd give quitting sugar a go. And I researched it for a number of weeks. I gave it a go, tested it on myself, and it had profound effects. So I started, Twitter had just been invented, and I started tweeting about it. I started blogging about it. I'd written a column about it, and it got lots and lots of interest. And as I was doing this, the science was emerging. I started attending conferences. There was also Goop, you know, Goop had sort of established around about this time. Anyway, the column was called This Week I ... and, you know, I would meditate with the Dalai Lama or whatever it would be. This Week I Quit Sugar. And so that became the I Quit Sugar movement. It was an ebook, and then it became a print book, and it just kept going and going and going. But what was interesting, Oliver, is that I witnessed the way that this self-help wellness movement grew in tandem with social media. you know, Twitter was invented, and then of course there was Instagram, Facebook, the whole thing quite some time later. And that brought, you know, a commerciality to it all. It also brought a whole heap of wellness warriors, many of whom were followers of mine, you know, in the early years. These were women who were a lot younger than me, decided that that was a career path for them. And you know, these are some of the people that ended up in a lot of trouble. Documentaries have been made about them. In several cases, two women died from their own advice, which was highly medically irresponsible. Yeah, so my skepticism probably grew as I witnessed what was happening to this space, and also how much of the world was handing over agency to these so-called experts that had these platforms on social media. So in many ways, I created a bit of a beast, and I also was part of it in real time. Yeah, it was an interesting time, and it's also interesting to exist in it now. A bit like yourself, I've written books more recently that try to bring it all together, because, of course, I think we do need wisdom and we do need guidance, but it needs to be quite tailored. But look, in terms of your skepticism, Oliver, I'd really love you to sort of outline what kind of triggered your skepticism. You did say that some of it did work, and some, I know that you're a fan of the Pomodoro technique, as am I, for getting writing done. But yeah, what was your skepticism? What was your deep-rooted concern?
Well, it's interesting. I feel like I mean, I will answer that question, but maybe in a roundabout way, because you're really bringing my attention to a slight difference in maybe the domains that we've been focusing on. Because one of the things that I thought was so great about what happened in the years after I began that column, certainly not as a result of me writing the column, but just in the changes in the culture, was this kind of democratization of advice when it came to things like how to construct a meaningful life, how to think about handling overwhelm, how to think about organizing your time and using your time. There was a sort of a, there has been a kind of a return to a kind of amateur involvement in the very best sense, that in many ways sort of reflects to some extent how philosophy was conducted in the ancient world and things like that.
That's a good point.
I have, you know, of course there were a million, you know, Medium posts around sort of 2010 or 2012 of just sort of random entrepreneurs claiming that the way they happened to run their morning routines was the right way for everybody, and it was sometimes a bit silly, but there was inspiration there, and their ideas weren't worse than other people's. And I was always pretty skeptical of the idea that very sort of narrowly conceived social psychology experiments were the main way to prove how people actually related best to their time and to happiness. And I would often use those kinds of studies in my column as a jumping off point, and then just completely abandon the question of whether the study was any good. So in a way, although I should probably have written about this more, I did feel slightly vindicated when it turned out that like half of those social psychology studies were in fact rubbish and had failed to replicate. But you're talking about the application of this amateur spirit. Maybe it's just a question of a different domain. Maybe you just can't do that with nutrition and physical fitness. Maybe it's just fundamentally different in certain ways, because of course what you're bringing up speaks to the whole kind of decline of trust in experts, and it's all obviously that's become part of the sort of wellness to conspiracy theory pipeline is a thing now. And so actually the thing that I originally rather liked about what was happening to self-help in a broad sense around that time, I can see very easily how it would be a very bad thing if it turned into sort of making claims about diet, you know, forms of dietary advice that were just not real. In order to give you some sort of concrete thing about what I'm actually skeptical about, I mean, there's one thing which I think we can talk about is the sort of political side of this, the idea that self-help as an idea remains very sort of individualistic. It has this implication that, you can positive think your way out of the situation you're in, you probably negative thought your way into it, and therefore broader societal systemic things don't need to be addressed. That's a viewpoint that has been sort of challenged in the last sort of 3 or 4 years much more strongly than ever before. And I think it has always been a real issue in self-help, going back a long way, this notion that you're responsible for everything that happens to you in the sense of blame. I think there is some sense in which it might make sense to talk about being responsible, but not the cause. You know, this idea that if you're poor, it must be your fault. Absolutely absurd, and very sort of, it's a very American ideological idea. So there's that. The other part of it, though, that I've become more sensitized to recently, and was probably more of a, you know, victim of myself. I don't think I ever started becoming a sort of hyper individualistic libertarian person, politically speaking, as a result of self-help. But the other part of it is that a lot of it is actually gets used by individual people as a kind of avoidance, so that the advice that we go out and seek is not the advice that we need to hear. The changes that we need to make in our lives, and that you will eventually, if you sort of embark on a lifelong quest of trying to figure these things out and reading lots of older books and spiritual books and going to therapy and all the rest of it, you may hopefully happen upon. It's often not the stuff that you're just going to get if you're marketed at directly by the most popular self-help authors. So the classic sort of example of this would be somebody who is in the market for business books, telling them how to cram more and more tasks into their day, when actually, you know, their problem is that they're a workaholic and they need to look at what it is that they're avoiding emotionally by investing the whole of their energy and attention into their work. It's just one example among many. I came to realize that actually pretty much it's almost a rule of this field that that the advice that you really like and get excited about and want to implement immediately is probably just enabling something negative in you. And the advice that strikes you as confronting and annoying and makes you feel like it would be really awkward and tedious to have to go think about it anymore is very possibly the advice that you need. So I'm actually skeptical just on that solo level, as it were, that individual level, about how the standard marketing of, right, because if all you're doing is trying to sell somebody something, then you're just going to do whatever it is that they think they need in the most immediate sense, and that might well not be the case.
I think that's probably where we intersect quite heavily. I feel that the self-help wellness realm has been co-opted by the neoliberal imperative. And what we've really seen is sort of almost a reversal of what philosophical wisdoms and spiritual guidance has always been about. So we are inherently quite individualistic and selfish. It's part of a survival mechanism. However, you know, we don't have fangs to defend ourselves. We're not particularly fast runners. We don't have a sting in our tail. What we've always had is this ability to communicate and form community and tribes, and it's through that we've been able to defend ourselves and rise to the top of the food chain, et cetera, et cetera. But what spirituality, what religions have done, what moral leaders, what philosophers have done, what they've done is they have ensured that individualism doesn't run too rampant, and we swing the pendulum back towards community because we need that nice sweet spot to be able to survive and flourish as humans. And that has always served, you know, a very important purpose, and it's worked particularly well. You know, in the 1970s and 1980s, the neoliberal system, you know, sort of what David Brooks refers to as got rid of these sort of moral guardrails. And he's referring to things like community groups, even, you know, church. We're talking the scout movement, trade unions, whatever it might be. These groups that served that purpose were essentially removed from our culture. And I write about it in my book. As you might recall, I refer to them as, you know, we got rid of the moral umpires of the footy field of life. And so we're now running around playing a game with no rules and no umpires, which is really not a hell of a lot of fun. And how that manifests, I think, in the self-help realm, and it speaks to what you were referring to, is that we cherry pick the information that's nice and kind of cozy. So we go through the various Buddhist traditions, whatever it might be, the Stoic tradition, and we pull out the bits that are nice. And I call it spiritualism light, you know, the diet version of this. And it was, you know, spiritualism light, self-help light, diet, the diet version. And what that looks like is we do the yoga classes, we do the sound baths, we do the bits of advice that reinforce the things that we are already doing, and we leave out the stuff that the spiritualists said was fundamentally important, and that was sacrifice and sitting in discomfort to build a resilience to get us through potential hard times down the track. That's what these traditions were about. And we've cherry-picked the bejesus out of these things, and it's been awfully pleasant, but it has left us feeling fairly unnourished, but also has led to, as you alluded to earlier, things like these information silos, you know, this correlation with conspiracy theories, the wellness realm, and, you know, very much crosses over with people who got caught up in COVID conspiracy theories, but also more contemporary conspiracy theories. And you can see how it can happen. It's this idea of the sovereign being as most, you know, as all important. It's kind of the extension of all this. And Nietzsche predicted all of this many, many years ago when industrialization, you know, first hit Europe. He sort of predicted this. So that's kind of my beef with it, as well as this idea of these self-help movements over the last 10, 20 years have been about removing us from discomfort, cocooning us from discomfort. And what's really interesting is that technological advancements over the last 30 to 40 years have, 70-90% of them, I think I've got that right, have been about removing discomfort. So we don't even have to sit in the uncertainty of wondering when our pizza is going to arrive because there's an orb on the app that tells us exactly where it is in the neighborhood. We don't have to wonder whether, you know, what the capital of Afghanistan might be, whatever it is, because we can go and Google it. We don't have to wait for anything. We don't have to sit in uncertainty, in doubt, in an unknownness. And, you know, I often say this, we have cocooned ourselves from everything except for real life. And so it actually goes against what self-help is meant to be about. It's actually leaving us incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way of putting it. I guess where it connects with what I've written about, certainly the most recent, in my most recent book, is that we're sort of very, sort of a good rule of thumb for understanding where we go wrong when it comes to finding happiness and community and spending our lives doing meaningful, productive things, is that we sort of, we really hate to be brought into encounters with our limitations, with our finiteness, right? So
yes.
the very often that is to do with comfort and wanting to avoid discomfort. It can sometimes be more to do with it's a quest for a kind of invulnerability. So that the reason I'm pausing before I just completely endorse the idea that we're that when self-help goes wrong, it leads us just towards happy, peaceful, comforting things, is that there is also, and I know you want to talk about this, there is also this kind of strand somewhat more marketed at men for obvious reasons, very much working on the sort of rediscovery and repackaging of Stoic philosophy, where actually it's all about being quite bold and fighty and sort of kicking life in the ass and, you know, whatever, I don't know, but, you know, we're punching life in the face. And it's all about sort of bringing some sort of warlike status to achievement and personal development. And what's so interesting to me about that, though I think there is some merit in it and some merit in the Stoic tradition, is that actually that is also the comfortable option in a specific way for the people to whom it's marketed at. And, you know, I speak from some sort of personal identification with that, I think, right? This idea that you might be able to use Stoic thinking or any other form of sort of modification of your habits or your thinking to not feel emotional vulnerability, to be sort of so strong in the world that you wouldn't have to worry about the fact that you wouldn't have to worry about, you wouldn't have to feel anxiety, you wouldn't have to worry about where things are, what's going to happen next, or whether you have what it takes to do the things that you think you need to do. So there's a kind of there's a version of this that is much less about sound baths and child's pose, and much more about fighting to win the game of life. And actually it ends up being the same thing, which is in its bad versions, it ends up being the same thing, which is this sort of horror of acknowledging that we're finite in terms of how much time we have, which is the big focus of 4,000 weeks, but also finite in terms of how much control we have over how life unfolds, how much we can do alone without doing it in community. So I just feel like this is, it just mirrors everything. It just, self-help just mirrors society, right? We generally would prefer not to confront scary things, and occasionally we'll realize that actually that's what we need to do.
So. Yeah, the Stobro movement, as I've referred to it, and I think maybe some others have as well, emerged more recently.
Broicism, so that's what I heard.
Broicism, that's it. I think it's emerged more recently, and I think it's, it's all the ice bath stuff, and it really is, from the way I see it, is a response to, again, uncertainty, the doubt, the discomfort that the world is presenting. And I want to move on to where we're at now, off the back of that, because I think it's a very male or masculine interpretation of trying to regain control and cherry picking the stuff that reinforces the messaging that feels safe. And for men who are facing a really rough time at the moment with where their gender stereotypes are sitting, Stoicism seems to provide a nice framework. It's a very watertight framework, particularly when you cherry pick the bits out that suit your agenda. And this has been a criticism of a lot of Stoic professors when they witness, some of these Stobros out there, that they haven't embraced a really central tenet of Stoicism, and that is this idea of vulnerability. And we can see why a lot of men today would want to conveniently shut that piece of the picture out. But I'll just remind everybody listening in the audience to keep asking questions. And just to remind you, you can ask a question by clicking on the Ask Question button, which is under the video screen. You can see it pretty clearly there. Put your name in there if you'd like to. You don't have to, and then press send, and we'll get to those at the end. Okay, so let's move on, Oliver, to where we are at now. I think the world is in desperate need of guidance. We're in a time of incredible flux, and in such times throughout history, we've generally needed some great uprising of philosophical thought. It might be a religious movement. It might be a philosophical movement, but as I mentioned earlier, the neoliberal imperative has meant that a lot of those moral guardrails have been removed. We just don't have them in place. There is not a healthy respect for philosophical discussion. I mean, it is happening, and I take your point that the self-help space is probably the only space that brings this to the mainstream. It does do it in bits and pieces in a very diet version. But in terms of institutions that are able to steer a society through difficult times, it's really hard to point to where they are right now. And we need them more than ever as the climate crisis gets worse, as we see, the AI threat, we see nuclear threat dialing up, and bifurcation, fragmentation, polarization, the whole thing. And I'm wondering, is this why you decided to write 4,000 Weeks? Do you feel that the world needs a simple piece of guidance? and then for those who haven't read it, could you just give a bit of an elevator pitch description of the book?
Sure. Let me do that bit first before denying that I wrote it okay. Because the world needed
to solve the world's problems.
Yeah, right. The world needed to hear my wisdom. That is not how it works for me. And I think there's an interesting topic there actually about books and writing probably. This is basically a little bit prefaced. I sort of got at this in my previous contribution, but it's about this the notion that we have a very finite amount of time. 4,000 weeks is very roughly and rounded down to get a good round number, the amount of average lifespan in the developed world. We also have very little control over how that life unfolds. And I think that most of the ways that we go wrong in managing our relationship with time, making the most of our time, both in sort of personal and professional sense and as citizens of the world, comes from trying not to confront those truths. And so actually, I make the case that it's incredibly liberating to realize that there will always be too much to do, that there will be more genuinely good causes than anyone can be expected to care about, that you will never feel like you're ready to launch the next phase of your life, whatever it might be. And so actually, once you sort of give up on hoping to achieve that kind of mastery or control over time, you're actually freed up to actually do stuff and make a difference in your life, other people's lives, in the world, because you're no longer seeking essentially to become a god with respect to your time. You can actually be more wholeheartedly human. I don't know about you, and I'll be fascinated in your answer to this question, but I do not write books because I think I've figured the world out and other people need to hear it. And it's going to sound like false modesty or something, but I write books as part of a kind of therapeutic process for myself that has the form of sort of writing the advice that I need to hear. So not only I'm trying to write a book that I think should exist, which is a pretty common thing that you hear people say, right? They looked for a book and they couldn't find it, so they wrote it themselves. But also, and I think this is probably pretty common, although not always acknowledged, also, it's the advice I could do with following, right? It's like, it's a question of what I am struggling with and what people, I arrogantly think, broadly enough like me, are struggling with, and trying to work out through the process of writing the book, you know, what the right direction is in which to move on all that stuff. So it's kind of awkward because sometimes people read my books and then get in touch with me, and you can tell from how they're emailing that they think that that I now live a life perfectly in tune with the sort of vision of how to live that is in the book. And like, I never actually make that claim because it's totally not true. And it's like, it wouldn't be a topic of interest to me unless it was something that I found quite difficult and challenging. So the book is very much like a partner in that process. And whenever I sort of get blocked and can't write anymore, I wander around smiting my forehead for a long time. And then I realize every time, I have to remember it again, it always takes weeks seemingly, but that actually the way to get on track again is to ask what it is at this very moment that I'm sort of struggling with myself, and that's something that gives the book life, I hope, and seems to have given the book life for enough other people. So that's how it works for me. The other thing that I find more and more, and I don't know if this is a bit defeatist maybe, but it does seem to be the thing that means the most to people when they respond well to the book or to other things that I write. It's not that I offer them some great solution that they hadn't thought of before. It is that sense of a share of the fact that we're all in the same boat, and that behind our facades, we're experiencing a lot of the same things. Quite often, I'm talking about all the nice feedback, which is kind of, I don't mean to brag, but it's like, it's a big important part of it for me is getting this kind of resonance with people. And one of the things that people say a lot is like, this is what I've always thought, or you've put into words something that I knew but had not put into words. And, you know, you might think that was a bit of a sort of double-edged compliment, because it's sort of like, well, I already knew this, what are you telling me? But I think it's actually that's the moment of connection, because actually you can't learn something new about the meaning of life from some guy writing a book. What you can do is have ideas that were just below the surface brought into the surface, and feel that kind of, oh, someone else understands, because actually it's just lots of us. So I'm just trying to get more honest, I guess, as I write these books, and I'm sure I'm mainly not doing. I was accused rightly by somebody else in a podcast interview a while ago of keeping most of my personal life out of my books, and that's true. And I think it's because why would anyone be interested? But actually, it probably is because I am inhibited in some way. So, you know, and which is not to say my next book will be a sort of tediously transparent memoir or something, but you know what, it's that,
well, you are British, you know, even if you lived in America for a long time.
You have to be who you are.
Well, we've somehow segued into how we write books, but it's probably relevant. I'll just chime in there. I work in a similar way, except that I'm out in the world. I'm a 50-year-old single woman who has lived on the road for 15 years or longer with one bag of belongings, and I'm extremely online. So I often develop a book idea based on what I sort of refer to as smelling the pain in the zeitgeist. I can feel the pain and I live it and I breathe it and I ache for it, and I set off on a journey and I write the book in real time. So my most recent book, First We Make the Beast Beautiful, I was trying to fathom how the hell we could find a meaningful, joyful path through, you know, excuse the language, but the clusterfuck of the climate crisis, the fragmentation that was happening. Me Too was happening at the same time. Black Lives Matter was happening. And all around me, there were fires. Then, of course, COVID hit. So all of this was happening. And I was trying to fathom a path through it all. And so I literally set off for 3 years. And my background as a women's magazine editor meant that I knew I needed to add a sexy layer to this thing. So I set off around the world and hiked in the footsteps of philosophers, thinkers who had felt this pain or smelt this pain before. And so I do, I think it's about 20 hikes around the world to arrive at something that resembled a thesis. In the meantime, or along the way, I appreciated, found, you know, delved into the science on how walking in nature, there's 42,000 studies that show it can actually bring us back into the things that really matter to us. And, you know, identified that it was a disconnect, an absolutely profound moral loneliness that we were feeling. Not an aloneness from each other, but an aloneness from a relationship with ourselves, but also with what I refer to as the moral matrix of life. And the Greeks called that acedia. Acedia is like a listless slothfulness. So reconnecting with this one wild and precious life, and yes, Mary Oliver's estate gave me permission to use that line in this book. Reconnecting with us actually puts us in a position to get very clear on how we wish to save it and gives us that fired up energy to do it. So I do it for a similar reason, but I guess in some ways I had been feeling that the world was missing guidance. My skepticism in and around self-help had to do a little bit of a full circle. And I think a little bit like yourself, my experience from pulling apart all of these ideas over my career, you start to see the things that really work, that stand the test of time, that actually engage humanity at a very visceral level. And I know from reading your book and talking to a lot of people about your book and interviewing you on my podcast about it, I think that that's sort of almost what you do as well. You bring together the thinking that makes a hell of a lot of sense after all of the guff that's been around there. I'm wondering if, I mean, you mentioned the feedback that you've received from readers, but I'm wondering if you could talk to anything that you've learned about where we are at right now. A bit like you, the world has even shifted once again. I think things are feeling particularly perilous. You know, it's been an incredible summer here in Australia, my homeland. Fires are already starting at the beginning of spring. Moving into summer, it's going to be a hellscape. So I'm thinking that we are going to need something more than flimsy spirituality light, self-help light in coming years. What are some themes that you are exploring or have observed from, well, since your book came out, that you think are going to be really important for listeners to think about?
It's interesting. I guess one of the places where this intersects with, you'll want to jump back in because I think this is really your territory, but it is at the end of my book and then it's been part of the conversation since then, is that there is something ill-suited about the idea of hope. You know, I think certainly in the context of the climate, but also just as a general kind of orientation, there's something sort of flimsy and unconvincing about the idea that we should all be very optimistic about the future. There is actually, you know, there are always those people. I wrote a long Guardian piece about them at one point, who are writing the books and communicating the fact that there are an enormous number of things that are going well and getting better. I don't think that's false. But that as a sort of spiritual, psychological outlook, we need something other than just sort of constantly buoying ourselves up with the idea that things are going to necessarily get better. And I actually think that can be a very liberating move to make. I was really impacted a long time ago by an essay that the environmentalist Derek Jensen wrote called Beyond Hope, which is all about how easy it is to sort of give power away when you are invested in feeling hopeful about things, and that you don't really need hope. People talk as if we need to be hopeful, otherwise we might all just sort of sink into depression, but that isn't the way we already relate to some of the most meaningful things in our lives. If you're a parent, you don't only care for your child because you hope that they'll turn out to be really successful in their adulthood, right? That would be absurd or almost sort of psychopathic to make it conditional on their children. You do it because you love them, and that's true of all kinds of love, really. And Jensen was making that point. I think the other part of this that sort of connects to my interests in sort of being in our finiteness is that there's a kind of person who is not complacent about what's happening to the world, who is deeply well motivated by wanting to make things better, but who is in a different kind of denial of their finitude and sort of works themselves up into a paralyzed state by trying to get their arms around it all and solve everything. So
you raise a really good point there, and I wanted to bring it up earlier and I completely forgot about it, so thank you for the reminder. I mean, we should bear in mind that the term self-help, or self-care I should say, actually emerged in the 1970s. The black activist Audre Lorde first, you know, uttered the word self-care, and it was in reference to the women, the black women who were on the front line fighting for pretty fundamental stuff, and as you point to, were exhausting themselves, absolutely, you know, working themselves to the bone. Then they had to go home and feed children, et cetera, et cetera. And so she would say, you need to do the self-care. You need to go home, have a bath, feed yourself properly so that you can come back to the front lines and continue the fight. And, you know, as part of our spiritual light cherry picking process, we have done the self-care. We go home, have the bath, light the candles. However, we don't then use that rejuvenated energy to go out and fight for this one wild and precious life. And so once again, we've kind of co-opted a term and just chosen the bits that are conveniently comfortable, and it's not serving us. It's not serving us. And I suppose picking up on your idea of hope, I take what you're saying, but I've actually just started writing my next book, a very painful process. I know you're at the end of writing one of your books, your next
book.
No,
middle. No, horrible middle. Anyway,
I think you're meant to be at the end, but anyway, I won't remind you of that. I'm meant to be in well into the writing processes, but it's been 2 years of wrestling with the research. But I do start off the first chapter, and I share it with my Substack community, which is where I'm sharing sort of these chapters as I write them. There's a really good idea for you, Oliver. That'll get you to the deadline. It's a community who are expecting an installment each week. But I started off by saying I no longer have hope. And I've been a climate activist most of my life. I've been an activist of, you know, one sort or another, you know, pick a cause. I go out there and wear the T-shirt and try to educate people on it. I spend a lot of my time doing it. But I no longer have hope, because I do feel that hope, you know, there's a term out there it's called hopioid. It has actually become something that when we are in fact trying to fight for change, which is I think where many of us are feeling we need to be at the moment, we can actually slip into this idea of hope And what's happening, I'm seeing in the climate movement, but also in other movements, is that what we're hoping for is not coming to fruition. So we're not bringing down carbon emissions. Governments aren't changing their policies in time. Big corporations are reneging on their earlier commitments. And so that sends us into a worse despair. So I'm positing this idea that we should be working to something far more stoic in many ways, and that is truth, like radical truth. And that, you know, takes us full circle back to this idea of the wisdom of sitting in discomfort. And your book, you know, talks about this so much, about confronting our finiteness. And, you know, there have been dozens, if not hundreds, of philosophers and spiritualists over the years that have pointed out that to truly live, we need to confront death. And that's where we're at in the world today. You know, the predictions are looking ghastly. You know, this is sort of the space I'm in at the moment. And so, you know, the self-help techniques of recent yore are not working. However, wonderfully, incredibly, some of the self-help wisdoms of many hundreds and thousands of years ago are actually, I think, surfacing once again. Mm. But only to the extent that we take the full package, we don't cherry pick, and we absorb the lessons around sitting in discomfort, because there's a hell of a lot of discomfort that's going to come our way in, well, we're in it now, but in coming years and in the coming decade or two. And the sooner we can do that and educate and inspire our children to be able to sit in that and to adopt some of these approaches to life, rather than thinking that, you know, my child comes home and has done all these wonderful activities at school about recycling and, you know, conserving water and things like that. You know, I've got great hope in this next generation. And I have to say this to them, Oliver, well, listen, first of all, your child's 8. They're not going to be able to vote for another 10 years. So there's that. They're not going to be able to make a big impact. Secondly, children should be able to get on with their lives being children. And thirdly, the change needs to be happening now. 8 years is you know, or 10 years is where we're going to have missed the opportunity. So that's my position on hope. We probably only have 1 or 2 minutes before we've got to cross over to questions. What I might ask, which I think people would be really fascinated to know, Oliver, and we'll have to keep it to sort of a quick 30-second answer each, perhaps we could share what self-help technique we actually do use in our day-to-day life. What have you taken from all of these years of researching this space? What have you taken away and you actually use daily?
I mean, I'm in a constant state of flux, right? It's not that I've tested them all and abandoned them all. It's that I pick them and use them and then they stop being useful and then I move on to other ones. And making my peace with that was actually really helpful, giving up this notion that I was looking for one system. If there has been a continuity like all the way through, I think it is morning pages. It's been a bit disrupted here and there by a newborn and things like that. But basically, I've written 3 sides of stream of consciousness, nothingness, whatever is coming out. First thing with coffee for a very long time now, totally unstructured, not an exercise in creative writing, usually more kind of me working out my random problems, but sometimes absolutely substance free, but incredibly useful, I think.
Yeah. Well, for me, I do use the Pomodoro technique, an app, the app version of it. I use that when things are really stuck, but I also meditate every day. It's sort of non-negotiable for me. And I should probably add, I also don't eat sugar. So I have stuck to that in case anybody's wondering. Now, we do need to cross to questions. I think we've got 5 questions here. We may have time for an extra one if anyone is wanting to post a last minute one. Oliver, this question's for you. Your book talks about humans having a lifespan of 4,000 weeks. Our perceptions about time and how we manage it differently over time and in other cultures. So are they different in different cultures? And that's from Sally.
Yeah, I sort of focus in the book on difference over on a sort of longitudinal way as opposed to a cross-cultural way, although this is true in both those senses. There are definitely, there have definitely been many people at many times in history, and there are some in some cultural contexts today who I would describe as sort of having a less alienated relationship with time. It is less a case that that there's themselves and then there's time, and they feel sort of like we do all the time, you know, hounded by time or trying to fight time, trying to wrangle or wrestle or manage time so that we're in control of it. There is the alternative, the one that anthropologists call task orientation, where the rhythms of your day just emerge from what you're doing. It tends to be in places and at times in history where people have been living very close to the land in terms of their what their work is. There are all sorts of others. I think the really important point about that is not so much that we should be like somebody else or that somebody's got it right, but just that it is negotiable, right? This notion that we have that like time is this very linear, very mathematically regular thing that it is our job to try to squeeze the most out of, like that's a set of beliefs. And you might have to follow them a lot of the time. You might want to follow them a lot of the time, but they're still a set of beliefs which gives a certain kind of psychological room for maneuver, because it means that you don't have to be completely wedded to this idea and that there are all sorts of things to do in the world that actually it's helpful to be in a different frame of mind about time and to think about it as just a sort of the medium in which life unfolds rather than this thing you have to be constantly battling.
Yeah, that's a lovely reframing. Okay, the next question is from Amal, and it's for me. Sarah, your book is described as a guide to living a wilder, more connected life. Can you explain exactly what you mean by wilder? I can, Amal. So I suppose it speaks to a little bit of what you just referred to there, Oliver, and that's this idea of being connected to the rhythms of life. So that's one way that point can be interpreted. And so hiking, and I talk through the rhythms of hiking, I talk about the science of how it is that it makes us feel so good, how it leads to profound and discerning thought. And so, you know, all kinds of philosophers, poets, scientists hike to get their best ideas, and there's lots of stories that I relay in the book about that. And it fits to this idea that, you know, in one of my favorite studies, there's 42,000 of them. I read quite a number of them. You don't have to read them because I paraphrase them in my book. But, you know, for example, the patternings in nature work to fractals, repeated patterns that form a spiral, or the fronds of a fern or the petals of a flower. And our retinas are also made up of fractal patternings. And when we see these patterns in nature, there's this congruence, there's this recognition, this plugging in. I almost describe it as that feeling with a MacBook, you know, when you get that suctiony feeling. I think it's a model or three ago, where it had that lovely kind of connected, sucked in feeling. But I also talk about it from a spiritual perspective. And I reference the incredible American Buddhist nun Pema Chodron, who talks about going to your edge. She's not the only person to talk about it, but I found her work in the book When Things Fall Apart to be really, really helpful. And she talks about going to our edge is going to that point where we do feel deeply uncomfortable. And at that point, instead of resisting and running, we stay at this edge. And it's at this edge that the breezes are fresh and alive. We come online, we have to fend. I describe it as almost like being in a tree. We can either hang around the trunk, cocoon ourselves, or we can go out to the outer limbs where it is more precarious. It feels edgy. It is uncomfortable. But we get the perspective. We can see that we are in a tree and there are other people out there. I'm not going to run this metaphor too far. But, yeah, I think it is about exploring these ways of being that are very much fundamental to the way humans have always operated and which we've just simply forgotten. And when we go to the edge, when we go into nature, we don't have to do much more than just do that and sit in it, and the magic then happens. The wildness returns. We remember. People say to me, how does hiking, what do I need to do to get hiking right? And I'm like, just go and start walking in nature. That's it. It will do its thing. It works no matter what. So I hope that answers your question, Amal. Okay. This person hasn't given their name, but they've asked, how do we find the balance between the drive for perfectionism and the acceptance that we and life will always be imperfect? Oliver, do you want to have a crack at that one?
Yeah, I don't need to manage the drive for perfectionism. That's just like an annoyingly unavoidable thing that I have. So all my effort is engaged in the opposite direction. I used to think a long time ago that perfectionism was sort of a double-edged sword, right? It's kind of nice to be seeking perfect results, but you need to be careful that you don't go too far with it. And now I sort of feel that it's basically all a problem, or it's another, or perfectionism is another word for the things that that cause me to get in my own way when it comes to being somewhat productive and effective in the world. So I think it's very personality dependent, but I think if you're the kind of person who is afflicted by some version of perfectionism, like, it's just an endless process of reminding yourself that perfectionism, perfect results, don't exist in the real world, right? It's not that you fell short. It's that you're trying to reach a standard that cannot exist, and that you know, the real lesson to perfectionists need to learn, I think, is not that you could fail or you could screw up, but that you already have, right? The ship has already sailed. If you were trying to live a perfect life, that's over. So you can let go of it, which is brilliant. And now you can just
I like that.
Now you can just do some stuff instead.
Yeah, no, I like that. I have I think it's all very well to say, oh, just don't worry about being perfect. But I think you do need to have some like little mantras or little wisdoms that work for you. And I'll share some for whoever asked the question that I use and find helpful. So I had a meditation teacher who used to witness my tight grip on life. And, you know, people who write books tend to be A types. People who then sign on to listen to a podcast in their evening tend to be A types as well. So we will all relate to this, but I grip really hard. And that's when it's sort of like I'm blocking the flow of life when I do that. I'm trying too hard. I'm emailing too many people. I'm just pushing. And it blocks the natural flow. And my meditation teacher, Tim, used to say to me, Sarah, stop thinking that this is where the story ends. Keep the camera rolling. And that did the similar thing to me. It actually freed me up and opened thing, expanded my perception of how life actually works and my place in it. And I realized it doesn't stop here. It can go a bit wobbly, but the story hasn't ended. It just keep the camera rolling. Show up, turn up, don't be defeated by it. And just step into the next chapter of it all. The same person used to also say to me, take your filthy mitts off it. And that works for me as well when I'm gripping too tightly and being too perfectionist. But look, you know, I think it's about pulsing. I need to make friends with something before I can release my grip on something. So I can see that my perfectionism has really worked for me at times. And once I accept it and see it as a beautiful thing, the title of my previous book was First We Make the Beast Beautiful. When you make a beastful thing, in that case, it was anxiety, beautiful, we can then start to modulate and manage that difficult entity. Okay, we've got a couple minutes left. We've got another two questions. We'll see if we can get them both in. We may not. Both of you have written impactful books. Which came first, the actual practice of living in a new way or the book writing process itself? Oliver.
I'll keep this really quick because A, we're running out of time, and B, I think I sort of answered this before. These are not separable. The book writing is the process of living in a new way or trying to live into it. What tends to happen with me is I'm really good on the intellectual insights. I figure things out on an intellectual level really quickly. I come up with a sort of high concept for a book or something like that pretty easily, and then it takes forever to kind of follow through the actual embodied real consequences of that sort of insight. And so that is what the book writing is. It's just the same thing.
I would say pretty much the same thing. And look, we've got 2 minutes, so I'm going to answer the last question so that person doesn't feel left behind. Do each of you have one top tip for being just a bit happier? And that's from Jasper. Thank you, Jasper. I would say keep the camera rolling. I very much operate to that. I also switch. I have this other little mantra that I work to, and that is that often when I'm anxious, and it's no big secret, I have bipolar and I also have obsessive compulsive disorder, so perfectionism is something I'm very familiar with. But when I'm feeling anxious, and it can get debilitating at times, when I can, I try to say to myself, you know what? This is just me being excited. Excitement and anxiety trigger responses in a very similar part of the brain, and it's a very similar response. And our brains, if we reframe it, can actually start to respond to things differently with the language that we use. It works for me. And so whenever I'm having a bit of a tough time, I do reframe things as this is exciting. I've also become a yes person. This sounds so Pollyanna-ish and cliched, but I have an autoimmune disease, which renders me absolutely exhausted at times and depressed and anxious. And I can be very, very tired, and it'd be very easy to say no to things. I try to work to a default of yes, where the invite comes from somebody who genuinely wants me to be there. So that would be it. And also walking in nature, it just works. Like I say, just start walking and it does its magic. I skip through the forest. I had to imagine how many people have seen the crazy lady dancing in the forest. I'll put music on and I get to a spot and I dance. And it's a very, very happy, happy experience. As I say, just start walking, just start walking in a park, wherever it might be, and it will do its work for you. You don't have to think about it. Okay, we're finished right on time. Oliver, my massive thanks to you and to our audience for your questions and for taking part this evening. And to, of course, Intelligence Squared for hosting this podcast. Very much appreciate it. And I've enjoyed it. And Oliver, I'm sure we'll cross paths again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, everybody, for being part of it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.